on which their intellectual system is based. So, as we saw, one of structuralism's characteristic views is the notion that language doesn't just reflect or record the world, rather it shapes it, so that how we see is what we see. The post-structuralist maintains that the consequences of this belief are that we enter a universe of radical uncertainty, since we can have no access to any fixed landmark which is beyond linguistic processing, and hence we have no certain standard by which to measure anything. So the rebellion there is that if you follow a system to its logical conclusion, and it doesn't account for everything, and you still try to make meaning within that system, you are basically creating a uncertainty. So language is never fixed, language is never certain. So the structuralists, if we look at the origins of the differences between the two things, and sometimes this is, feels like it's splitting hairs, or so what, or what exactly are you trying to say? Language systems for structuralists can reveal the truth about a text if we pay enough attention. We'll always crack it. If we understand what the rules are, we will always get to the meaning of a particular text. But the origins of post-structuralism, partly because they arise out of a philosophical rather than a scientific and linguistic system, are sceptical about any kinds of truths in meaning-making. We cannot know anything for certain. And partly, of course, this does arise out of the fact that semiotics, structuralism, arises out of a science of semiosis, a linguistic science, an actual study of lots of language systems. Here's the signified, this is the signifier, this denotes something, this connotes something else. We have a system, we can analyse any kind of utterance. Whereas the post-structuralist looks at that and says, but how do you know that? How do you really know that? So having got a few certainties under your belt last week, it's just confusion all the way this week with post-structuralism. Hopefully not. So structuralism derives from linguistics. Linguistics is a discipline. And post-structuralism derives from philosophy. And philosophy, as we know, it's a discipline that's always tended to emphasise the difficulty of achieving secure knowledge about anything. And of course Nietzsche's famous remark, there are only facts, and there are no facts, only interpretations. So let's have a bit of an example there. Okay. The example that's often quoted, and let me just get the actual text for you, is from Barthes, and maybe Andrew mentioned this last week, the example of the train, where you're in a train. Okay, pro-structuralist view of being in a train, unless you're in the one that I was in this morning, which didn't move anywhere in any vague description, but that experience of being in a train and the train next to you starts to move so that you feel that you're in motion. That's a way of understanding it. But you're not really in motion, but your perception of it and your meaning, the meaning that you're making from that situation is that you're travelling, that you are in motion and you're moving somewhere. And the reason why you believe that is that your actual reference points to the ground are gone and your only reference point is to another moving object. Does that make sense? So that's what people use as an example of this. And actually it was a surreal experience because the train I was on wasn't moving, and then the driver came over the tannoy and said, I'm having some trouble with traction, I need to reboot the system, and the lights might go out. So I was in an even more uncertain world than I thought I was. I thought I was just on a train that was running late. But reboot? Has anybody been on a train that's needed to be rebooted before? No. It's strange. Also, actually, while we're on the subject of strangeness, let me just show you a picture that I saw. This is something that I noticed in the Institute today. I hope it's there. Now, just thinking about the way that things are not what they seem to be. Sorry, it's such a long way in, and when I came in here, people were still in their meeting, and I couldn't get set up properly. Yeah, this one, I took this one this morning. Maybe you've seen this one on level 5. Have you seen that? on level 5, there's that sign. Once you begin to notice these things, it can start to seriously affect your mental health. But for the benefit of people in the part-time land, there's a sign on the door here that says, this door has changed. Right? Has the door changed? No. The reference point for your understanding of how to get through the door has changed. The door has not changed in any way. Where else do we see these sorts of things? Anybody else notice these sorts of signs that you see that really don't make any sense? How many people have done an exam and gone through to the back of an answer book, or in fact any kind of questionnaire, and seen the words, "This page has been left intentionally blank"? Yeah? So your reference points are, you know, slightly skewed again there. Has the page been left blank? No. I mean, this is why we're in the world of philosophy. Or the other one that comes up on the computer sometimes is, while this printer is idle, its status will not be reported. Right? But this is a box that's just popped up to report the status of the printer being idle, but it's saying that the status isn't being reported. So this is the kind of world that we're in, a world of uncertainty and where meanings shift and where doors can be changed because you pull them instead of push them now. But that example and the example of the train are serious attempts to try to get to the heart of what it is, because there is something in what post-structuralists say. But last year, I mean, some people had difficulty grasping that or thinking, well, yeah, but surely within the system we can break into it and create our own system within the text that we're trying to analyse. And of course you can. But you have to be aware that next week or next year a different group will do that rather differently, and that the meaning produced, well, they will be able to go into the world and report that the meaning of the text that they were examining, that Andrew showed them or that I showed them, is this. And they'll say, well, the meaning wasn't that. Your reference points were different. So your reference points are gone in the world of post-structuralism to an extent. Although, well, when we come on to it, you'll see Foucault says that that's actually yes, but it's replaced by something else, which is an understanding of how that potential for meaning-making is exploited under conditions of oppression and power, sometimes literally, and sometimes through the use of language in certain ways. So we're looking at four aspects, really, of the differences at this stage between structuralism and post-structuralism, because sometimes it's easier to say what post-structuralism is not, rather than what it is. So I'm just setting these up because binary oppositions are good between the two things. Well, sometimes you'll notice there's a bit of an overlap, though, just to make it very confusing. The style and the tone of the two things. If you read for your big book, if you've been reading structuralism and then maybe you've read something about post-structuralism or vice versa, or if you've read a text which comes from the scientific linguistic tradition and really examines an utterance or a language for the actual systems that are there, and then you pick up some Derrida and of grammatology, for example, and have a look in there, you'll see that the tone and style is completely different. Completely different. Okay. Basically, and to stereotype the two movements, structuralist texts, they tend towards abstraction, they're neutral and detached, and anonymous. There's an orderly step in the analysis, and one thing follows another. The tone and style of a post-structuralist text is more flamboyant and more emotive and more emotional. And I've written there urgent and even euphoric in tone, etc. But it's true. And there are some clips that you can see of post-structuralist writers and thinkers on YouTube. And if you search on Derrida, you'll see that it is very much about this performance. There's a famous clip, I'll show you just the first minute of it, where he talks about deconstruction, or he's asked about deconstruction. I need to get into my playlist. Where's my playlist? Not there. Oh. Right. My post-structuralist playlist. Hmm. This is a form in itself, you know, these things. Really, if you want to make a study of texts from a structuralist or a post-structuralist point of view, searching these, some of these clips on YouTube and what people have done to try to explain them to other people, it's a form in itself. I don't know if anybody's ever done this. It'll lead you around in circles. It's very, very interesting. Okay, the reader. This is what I mean about performance.
You're very well known in the States for deconstruction. Can you talk a little bit about the origin of that idea?
Avant d'essayer de répondre à cette question, je voudrais faire une remarque préliminaire sur le caractère totalement artificiel de cette situation. Je ne sais pas qui regardera ce que nous sommes en train de filmer ou d'enregistrer, mais je voudrais souligner, au lieu de les effacer, les conditions techniques. Ne pas feindre la naturalité là où elle n'existe pas. J'ai déjà commencé à répondre à votre question sur la déconstruction, parce qu'un des gestes de la déconstruction consiste en particulier à ne pas naturaliser, à ne pas faire comme si ce qui n'est pas naturel était naturel, comme si ce qui est conditionné par l'histoire, par la technique, par l'institution, par la société, était une donnée naturelle.
Okay, what happens next is some ambient music and then somebody's doing a voiceover about deconstruction while they play his image in slow motion. But it's, in a way, that's interesting. But the point I was trying to make really here was about the way that post-structuralists perform post-structuralism. And it's true of any of the hundreds of clips that you can find of Derrida towards the end of his life, actually, on YouTube, where it's, if you had to imagine an archetype of a particular kind of French intellectual, you might stereotype him in that way. I mean, it is very, very performed. The camera angles are strange. Sometimes they're over the back of someone's shoulder. And it's about this... intention is to create this uncertainty and so forth. And one of the ways that he did that very early on was by forbidding... I don't know if you know this, but he forbade any images to be made of him until, I think, 1970. There were no pictures of him in any books, any presentations or anything. And part of that was to do with the performance aspect of it, because by the time that he did, of course, come much more into the public domain with the publication of the three great books that he wrote, including of grammatology in the mid-70s and came to prominence, he was feted on shows and so forth as being not quite a celebrity. One can't imagine someone like this being a celebrity in 2008 in the UK. But very famous in France at the time. And so he was actually drawing attention to the fact in his performance about uncertainty, waving his arms about, providing all sorts of different kinds of examples, and very rarely answering the question. Okay. But deliberately not answering the question, not in a politician's way of not answering a question. Okay. That's tone and style. Attitude to language. Structuralists say that the world is really only understood in language, and it's only by that applying yourself to it. There's no external reality outside the system. Language is an orderly system, and the world can therefore be understood in a logical way which rejects chaotic interpretation. Post-structuralists say, because we are not actually 100% in control of the signifiers and the signified, we're not in control of the medium, and it's not even fixed in itself. We're in a continual state of uncertainty and even anxiety about meaning. Now, you might think this is slightly over the top. It's language, after all. What do you mean by anxiety? You know, I feel perfectly relaxed about the way that I use language, maybe. But actually, no. It's not the case. We are. If you think about it, the instances in which you use language is... don't want to make everyone paranoid and anxious now. But there are times when you have to phrase a difficult... writing a card to someone who's lost a loved one, or there are times when you're writing a letter is a difficult thing. Writing a letter to someone who's in financial control over you. Engaging in a difficult email with somebody who's running some part of the your work environment that you're feeling unhappy about or challenged about. The ways that people say, "Do you know what I mean?" to each other all the time, and some people say it more than others, and there's an anxiety there about, "Am I making sense to you? Do you know what I mean?" The way that people say that, I hope I have some kind of electric shock every time I say that. Okay. And particularly, I guess, in the exchange of ideas. It's true. If you're trying to explain an idea to someone, if you were trying to talk to somebody who wasn't here today and didn't experience the doorbell and the broken glass and Jarida talking about love and a surreal 10-minute introduction to the session, it would be hard for you to explain without continually saying, "Do you understand? Do you know what I mean?" We have an anxiety about our verbal communication, and we have an anxiety about our written communication. And we continually have this idea that we can be precise if only we work on it. And of course we can shape it to within, you know, as closed down an interpretation for the receiver as possible. But we are, once it's released into the world, it's gone. It's gone. And I think with deep regret about some of the emails I've sent in my life. I'm sure you do as well. Okay. The fourth way to distinguish between the two is the aims. Our fundamental aim of structuralism, because of the way it arises, at least in the European tradition, out of Saussure and so forth, is that we can know the world more reliably by understanding and interpreting its habitual categorizations and perceptions. It's linguistics, but it's kind of anthropology as well, isn't it? It's moving between those scientific domains. And we can question the ways in which we construct and categorize reality. And at the end of the day, we'll find some essential truth. That's what we'll find if we go in that direction. But post-structuralists would say, no, reason is untrustworthy and unattainable. The world is a product of complex and continually shifting social and linguistic forces. It's not knowable. Sorry. And in this view of the world, the individual is dissolved as an entity into a constructed set of texts and appearances. And Barthes, of course, later in life wrote about the death of the author, where there was only the text left. It didn't really matter that the author was writing in a certain way about a certain thing in a certain place, in a cottage in the Lake District or whatever. Once the text had entered the world, the text was set free. The author disappears from the act of reading it. You might say. Of course, in the curriculum, this is absolutely not the case, and there still is the cult of the author. There still is the necessity to know about the writer and to understand the world through understanding the life of the writer within the school system, certainly. It's only when you get to university and you go to an English literature degree and somebody says, right, up to now this is what you've thought, but now we're going to look at how the 20th century approached interpreting texts, particularly the middle to late 20th century, and we're going to say the author is not as important as we might have previously thought. It's just a flow of text into the world. Just going to pause for a moment there and just, any questions up to this point? Okay. Is it all completely baffling, or is it all, yeah? Well, I think maybe when we'll get into some key figures. I mean, this is where we've got up to, really, which was, it's a dramatic way to put it, that the author's died. But there's a definite shift of attention from writers into text, signalled by the work of Barthes and so forth. And he himself moved from this structuralist project into post-structuralism. And I don't know if any of you have read some of his the very late work. It has almost dissolved completely into a post-structuralist context. There's a very beautiful essay that he wrote about photography towards the end of his life called Camera Lucida, I think it's called. Does anybody know that book? And it's just a meditation, really, on photography and what it means. And this is before Flickr and before any of those other things. And it can be read usefully in the context with Susan Sontag's thing, which was written about the same time, on photography. Both books are absolutely brilliant. But actually, Bart might have been later than that. But it's dissolved, and it's not precise, and it's not where he started from. And he's made this shift, he's made this move. It's interesting that in this subject we're still talking about authors, though, isn't it? There's an inherent contradiction at the heart of this presentation. Okay, Derrida. In the original, Derrida's texts are very difficult to read, very, very difficult to understand. And the classic text is of Grammatology, where this quotation comes from. The writer writes in a logic whose proper systems, laws, and life his discourse cannot dominate absolutely. He uses them only by letting himself, after a fashion and up to a point, be governed by that system. And the reading must always aim at a certain relationship, which is actually unperceived by the writer, between what he commands and what he does not command of the patterns of language that he uses. This relationship is not a quantitative distribution of shadow and light, of weakness or of force, but a signifying structure that critical reading should produce. Any ideas what that means? Do you experience that moment that you get when people are trying to explain about the particle accelerator in CERN in Geneva? Which is, an atom has protons and neutrons and electrons, and then they say some other words. In the beginning we can see what he's saying here. It's when it descends into this kind of... the problem is that it gets a little bit carried away. It's almost as though it would be better... The text doesn't serve these concepts very well. These concepts are difficult, aren't they? It would be better if he were here, in a way. Except then you'd get the gesture. But up to a point, you can see, especially if you've been thinking about structuralism from last week, the writer writes in a logic whose proper law, systems, laws, and life his discourse cannot dominate absolutely. In other words, this is why it's post-structuralist. It's accepting that the systems exist. It's not saying there are no systems. It's saying, of course there's a system. I understand that. But what my theories and those of my contemporaries who think the same way are saying, you can't control the system. It's there, but you can't control it. That's basically what the post-structuralist project is. It's saying you can understand it, you can interpret it, and you can use the disciplines of semiotics to get into that system, but you can't have absolute control over it. And then we have some poetry about shadow and light at the end, where it begins to dissolve again. For me, I find it more complex as that quotation goes through. Any other interpretations of that? There are probably many. Yeah.
Obviously, these are his thoughts and his words, and he's trying to get a certain point across, but at the same time, he's, I think, also trying to show you how uncertain, reading into a text and trying to figure out truly what those words mean.
I think you're probably right. And I think he's alluding to writers that have come before who assume that it can be fixed. And that's why he's using this shadow and light example. You noted last week the fondness of all structuralist writers at some stage will propose some kind of binary model. Except the American Pierce, it's a little bit different. There's a sliding scale of, there are three, isn't it icon, index, and what's the third one? There's a sliding scale. Anyway, it is slightly different coming from that tradition. But the European tradition from Saussure and so forth is that you can describe the world in terms of these binary oppositions, these things that travel together but appear to be contradictory.
So when he's talking about this relationship, he's talking about the relationship between the writer
Yeah. No, but it is, and that the reader knows that, and that the critical reading should produce that. Yeah. And this is one paragraph from a 400 to 500 page text of Grammatology, 1976. The other two on either side, Speech and Phenomena, Writing and Difference. There's a massive debate about Derrida still over whether it was essentially smoke and mirrors. Doesn't mean anything. It's all a complete. And one of the proponents of that is on YouTube. This video has been taken and it's been treated as a serious criticism. It's in no way intended to be, you know, funny or in any way critical of the person making this observation. But this is part of a much wider debate on YouTube about what Derrida means.
So today I want to talk about the French philosopher Jacques Derrida. Now, if you haven't heard of Jacques Derrida, you can consider yourself very lucky, because he's probably the most overrated intellectual in the last 50 years. Well, actually, that prize might go to Michel Foucault, but that's a lecture for an entirely different day. Now, a lot of people are under the impression that Derrida actually had something interesting to say, because nobody can understand what the fuck he's saying. I mean, if you try to read his books, they're gibberish. I mean, I imagine they don't make much more sense in French than they do in English, but I can tell you they don't make much sense in English. And I imagine that there's a kernel of an idea somewhere hidden in all those clauses and prepositional phrases and real fucking pretentious uses of Greek words and...
Okay.
Terminology that no human being should possibly...
Interestingly, I mean, as you go through, there's some really serious points being made in here about the way in which you work with text, the way in which you work with high ideas. And this guy has posted up some fantastic videos about learning and teaching and pedagogy. You know, when you watch them, you can reflect on a lot of... He's playing it for laughs with his delivery and everything. But there's some interesting ideas in there. And this has sparked, this particular video has sparked an awful lot of responses. This guy here who actually takes issue with him on several points whilst conceding that there are issues about the way that some of these ideas are expressed. And you get these lovely sort of little debates going on, which when you look into YouTube and you look at some of the ways that the ideas are approached, that's the value of YouTube, I think. Is when you see these kinds of exchanges taking place. Some of the other things where I'm not happy with the way in which someone will take one of the great thinkers like Foucault and make a video where they just throw words at a screen and that's enough. I don't think it's really enough. What this guy does is he actually takes the ideas on in some way and says, well, why can't you be clearer? And this response is because you can't be clear about some of these things because they're not fixed and they're very hard to describe and they're very hard to explain. And this one is mixed into another video later on about deconstruction. And someone's done some kind of Final Cut thing where they move the video around. I don't know if you've seen it, where they move this video around. I think it's this one, the ABCs of Deconstruction. This is the floating version of the Derrida video moving around the screen with some other images flying around and some other texts. But it's incredibly interesting. But there is that view. And certainly, you know, you step outside of the academy and so forth, and you think, well, what is the point, essentially, that's being made here, and how does it contribute to human understanding or the way that we live our lives? Does it have any particular bearing on it? Well, I think it probably does, and even the gentleman there says that there's a kernel of an idea in there, and he recognises it in it. And what irritates the hell out of him is the way in which it's expressed. But he's taken the trouble to post a 5-minute video about it. There's something there. If something is as inconsequential to you as that, you don't make a video about it. So there's a debate going on there, and a very interesting one at that. So that there's a kernel of an idea there. But how does it impact on our lives day to day, this sort of notion that nothing is fixed? Basically, the tremendous volume of misunderstanding that there is on a daily basis, whether doors have changed or not, whether trains are computers or not, whether, you know, what on earth is going on in the world? How does one know that what somebody said in a particular negotiation has been faithful? You know, then we get into all sorts of political ramifications. Because, of course, what the next key figure suggested was that into the vacuum created by the fact that we can't really know for certain what's going on, there are forces revealed in those discourses which are evident. There are structures which are evident. Once you deconstruct them, and once you take apart the different bits that don't appear to fit together, they don't appear to fit together because someone has put them in such a way as they can create some kind of power relation with you. So they've deliberately fractured your understanding to replace it with their own. And I think this is what Foucault's essential argument is, although he would say nothing like that, and he would say, I'm not a structuralist, I wasn't a structuralist, and I wasn't a post-structuralist either. But his writing follows throughout that period of time that structuralists and post-structuralists were writing, and they undoubtedly influenced it. That's why a much greater authority than me, John Storrie, stuck Michel Foucault in that chapter. It's because what does happen next? What is the logical end point of this post-structuralist argument? So I should say a little bit more, actually, about what is meant by this term deconstruction first. And that is that some of you might have seen this, actually. Did you see this in the Tate Modern until recently? Last year, this was in the a crack from one end of the turbine hall of the Tate Modern Gallery in London to the other, the whole complete length of it, by a South American, Ecuadorian, I think, artist, Doris Salcedo. Is she Ecuadorian or Colombian? I can't remember. Maybe Colombian, actually. Artist. And she made this crack through the floor, and nobody could see how it had been done, so you ended up with these people. This, to me, looks like, this is what I think of when I think of post-structuralism and deconstruction. Gosh, doesn't that sound pretentious? But I have to have some kind of mental, I don't know about how you are with these ideas and these concepts you've encountered in this course, but I have to have some image. And I have this image. And that is that the people in this are looking not at the continuity in the hall, at the polished part of the floor. They're looking at the crack. They're looking at why is it fractured? How was it made? And that is what deconstruction is. It's looking for those breaks, fissures in texts and artifact where things do not run according to the system, but the system is kind of fractured. So these people are all looking at this crack in the turbine hall, which was far more hazardous, actually, than the broken glass, as it turned out. Several people were injured. Even though they knew the crack was there and they'd come to see the crack, they still fell in it, some of them. Okay, so what is inside the text, then, for Foucault, is this idea that power is at the heart of discourse. Power relations are revealed in analysing and deconstructing texts, although he would have rejected either structuralism or post-structuralism. But what he thought of was power, was more as a sort of elemental thing. I mean, I think that there's a lot of political analysis that follows Foucault, but it's more that power is a neutral thing that's exercised in the world. Someone is always in a power relation to someone else. Something is always in a power relation to something else. And his greatest writing was that Discipline and Punish, and The History of Sexuality, which wasn't finished at the time of his death, but was a project of 8 years in the running up to that time. And the key writings of Foucault are in a condensed form and extracted really superbly in Paul Rabinow's edited thing here, the Foucault Reader. And it's a far more accessible way of getting to the heart of some of the ideas that Foucault had than going straight into Discipline and Punish, for example. Has anybody read any Foucault for their big book? Did anybody take on Foucault? We had some people last year. Someone read Discipline and Punish. Okay. And Foucault will come back into the course at different stages, but presumably you're aware that he had this view that, well, let's see if I can, there actually isn't that much available to give you about this here, but there is a very interesting quote at the start of talking about his work on prisons. Discipline and Punish. I'm sorry that this one isn't subtitled. Let me see. It might be quite hard to hear. I hope it's all right. I'll play a little bit of it anyway.
What I meant in this prison book was not that the disciplinary society starts with the development of the prisons. I would say exactly the contrary, since the problem which struck me when I was studying this field was this one. When you read the books written by the reformers or the social reformers of the 18th century, a very strong aggressivity against any system as the imprisonment. For a very simple reason, it is that prison was, at least in the French, the Italian, the German system, in the English one was a little different, but prison was not at all a punishment. It was an administrative measure which was taken against people outside of the law, outside of the juridical system, outside of the judicial institutions, only when the administration, the monarchic power, wanted to get rid of somebody. They put them in jail. So.
Okay. The basic idea behind what Foucault wrote then about power and discourse and communication. He's talking about prisons and how prisons were constituted and how prisons constituted order, was that the way that you communicate and the discourse around texts and artifacts does three things, three operations. Practices systematically form the objects of which they speak, right? So language as a discourse enables speaking, but it constrains what can be said, and it also constitutes the person saying it or the act of saying it. So the example would be, let me give you the example that John Story uses in here, the rules of a particular game, and this is perhaps the easiest way to understand it. Netball, okay? The game of netball as a discourse. To play netball, regardless of individual talent, you must be familiar with the rules of the game. They enable and they constrain your performance, but they also constitute you as a netball player. Okay? So, in other words, you're only a netball player if you play netball. So, being a netball player is not a given. It's enabled, constrained, and constituted in discourse. So you're enabled to be a netball player by playing netball, by obeying the rules, and the rules themselves make you a netball player, as opposed to a basketball player or a footballer or something else. That's how discourse operates. He also says, another example, academic disciplines are discourses. There's a table outlining the different ways film might be studied. Each discipline speaks about film in a particular way. but they don't just speak about film, they construct film as a specific object of study. So film was not meant to be an object of study, but the discourses that study film make film an object of study. It's a bit convoluted, but there is something there. There is the kernel of an idea there, isn't there? Yeah, so that it actually makes it into the object of study. And by constructing film as a specific object of study, they also constitute film as a specific reality. So he gives John Story on page 101 of that reader at the bottom there, has a nice table which illustrates how film is constructed in discourse as an object of study. You can look at the economics of it, so you're constructing it as a commodity. You can look at it in terms of literary studies, so it's an artistic text similar to a literary text. There are lots of eyebrows that could be raised at many of these issues, but never mind. History, you can study it as a historical document. Art history, as an example of visual culture. Cultural studies, as an example of popular culture. Or film studies, where the film itself is the textual object of study. And you will return to those kind of ideas if you do that film studies module, without a doubt. I'm not going to go on any longer about Foucault there, or about deconstruction. I just want to close by saying, giving you some nice binary oppositions, I suppose, as a summary of what you would do with it in terms of popular culture. Because as I said at the beginning, these ideas have to be useful to you in some way. If you're going on in the degree to be discussing popular cultural texts and artifacts in all sorts of different contexts, and some of them, for some of you, will be educational contexts, and for others, not necessarily educational contexts. What the difference between structuralism and post-structuralism means? So if you're adopting one or other position, what are you actually doing to the text that's different from what you did on the previous occasion? How is interpreting maybe this space that we're going to do soon different this week from looking at it last week in the context of Long and Parole and so forth? So on the left, structuralists, what do? When they do some popular cultural analysis, critique of popular culture, they look for systems, parallels, echoes, things that confirm that structures exist, certain arguments that can be made, reflections, repetitions, balances, symmetry, patterns, contrasts. And there at the bottom, they're looking all the time for evidence of textual coherence, unity and structure. On the other hand, your theorists of post-structuralism, when you read them, when you try to apply what they're saying to some of the artifacts and texts and practices that you're looking at, they seek contradictions and paradoxes, breaks in tone, attitude, conflicts, absences, linguistic quirks, floating and changing meanings, and evidence of textual disunity and incoherence. So where things don't really work.